Chapter 2. Viscosity. We saw in Chapter 1 that the defining characteristic of fluids is their ability to flow in response to external forces. At its most fundamental level, the science of fluid dynamics consists in predicting how a specific fluid deforms in response to an applied forcing, and, conversely, what force is required to move a fluid in a prescribed manner. Flow velocity. Fluid motion is quantified using the flow velocity. Since fluids can move in three independent directions of space, the velocity is a three-dimensional vector, denoted u, with each component measuring the velocity in a particular direction. Furthermore, because the fluid velocity can take different values at different locations in space, it is called a field. For example, in a river, the fluid on the riverbed does not move much, while the flow is much faster near the water surface. The mathematical framework to study the behaviour of continuum fields is called field theory, with countless applications ranging from electromagnetism and gravitation to quantum physics. In addition to its dependence on spatial location, the velocity in a fluid will often depend on time. In the river example, the flow might be slow in the autumn when temperatures drop, but much stronger in the spring when mountain snow is melting. Traditionally, we can quantify this time dependence in two ways. The first one, called Lagrangian, after the Italian-French 18th century mathematician Joseph Louis Lagrange, consists in considering a particular parcel of fluid and following it along its journey. When the fluid velocity increases, the parcel will have a positive acceleration, and when it decreases, the acceleration will be negative. This manner of measuring time dependence is intuitive to us, as it is the way we experience acceleration in a car or on a roller coaster. Unfortunately, the Lagrangian approach does not allow us to easily quantify and predict fluid motion, as, in order to use it, we would need to be able to follow every parcel of fluid for all time. Instead, fluid mechanics has adopted a different approach, termed Eulerian, after the 18th century Swiss Leonhard Euler, one of the greatest and most prolific mathematicians of all times, at the origin of countless contributions in both pure and applied mathematics. In the Eulerian approach, the time dependence of the velocity is not measured by following fluid particles, but instead by choosing a specific position in space and measuring the changes of the velocity in time at that particular location. Using the example of the river, this is akin to choosing a spot on the riverbank from which you stare at the river and keep track of the river velocity at that spot. Alternatively, it is like looking at cars passing by you on the side of the road and measuring how their speeds change in time. In the Eulerian approach, the velocity field is then denoted u, open parenthesis, x, t, close parenthesis, where x refers to a fixed position in space, and t is the time at which the velocity is measured. Flow kinematics. Of course, fluids flow in many different ways, and the world around us abounds with examples. From waterfalls and rivers to boiling water and cigarette smoke, it looks as if the possibilities for fluid motion are infinite. However, despite this apparent complexity, it turns out that all flow kinematics, that is, the mathematical description of how fluids can deform, can be described locally as the superposition of only three fundamental building blocks for fluid motion: translation, rotation, and extension. These three flows are illustrated in Figure 6, which can be found in the print version of the book. The simplest possible flow is a uniform translation, illustrated in Figure 6a, where, as is standard in the depiction of fluid motion, arrows are used to indicate the direction of flow, and solid lines called streamlines show the motion of fluid particles. A uniform translation simply measures how fast the fluid moves locally on average. Notably, a rigid body could undergo a uniform translation as well, so no intrinsic deformation is associated with that flow. The second fundamental flow is called a uniform rotation, as illustrated in Figure 6b. In that case, the fluid is rotating around a fixed direction. Here again, this type of motion is not specific to fluids, and a rigid body such as a Ferris wheel could also rotate around a particular direction. The third type of flow is called extension, or often pure extension, to emphasise that it does not include any translation or rotation, and is illustrated in Figure 6c. Qualitatively, in this flow, The fluid is contracting along one direction at a given rate, the horizontal direction in the figure, and extending along the other direction at the same rate, vertical direction. The streamlines are hyperbolas, which indicate that any fluid particle far from the centre of extension will be brought in mostly horizontally before being sent away mostly vertically. Importantly, while translation and rotation apply to both fluids and solids, a pure extension could not be experienced by a rigid body, as it would have to be stretched and compressed to accommodate the shape of the streamlines. An extensional flow is therefore the most fundamental signature of local deformation in a fluid. Incompressibility. In addition to the three fundamental flows described previously, two additional flows can also be relevant. However, because they cannot be obtained as a superposition of translation, rotation of extension, they have to be considered separately. The first of these flows is called a source, and it corresponds to the net expansion of the fluid, similar to the type of motion that would occur if an elastic material was stretched equally from all directions. The second flow is called a sink, and it is the inverse of a source. In that case, the fluid is being compressed equally from all directions, and an intuitive analogy would be that of an elastic sponge being squeezed. Sources and sinks are only allowed in flows if the fluid motion is compressible. A lot of research work has shown that this only happens if the velocities in the fluid are sufficiently large, at least on the order of the speed of sound in the fluid. The speed at which sound travels in water is approximately 1,500 meters per second. For all water flows where the velocity is much less than this value, the fluid motion is essentially incompressible and sinks and sources cannot be part of the flow. Given the very large value of the speed of sound, this constraint is clearly not a severe one, and all human experiences of water flow are in the incompressible limit. Exceptions will often occur in high-speed flows, for example for the flow around the rotor blades of submarines. In the case of air, the speed of sound is roughly 300 meters per second, and here also the flow of air with speeds well below this value is essentially incompressible. However, it is often counterintuitive to think of the motion of a gas as being incompressible when gases can clearly be compressed, and indeed many of us have already compressed air when inflating a bike tyre. The subtle point concerns the difference between an incompressible fluid and an incompressible flow. As a gas, air is a fluid that can be compressed. But in order to compress the gas, significant pressures need to be applied to it, and for low-speed flows, the general pressures won't be large enough to induce any notable compression of the gas. Counterexamples include the airflow around high-speed jets, able to break the sound barrier. In this book, we will only consider flows with speeds sufficiently small that they can safely be assumed to be incompressible. This is the relevant limit for all flows occurring in the living world, and in most industrial settings. An interesting consequence of incompressibility concerns the velocity field in the fluid U. Indeed, if the flow is incompressible, its velocity cannot be completely arbitrary, because it cannot contain any sources or sinks. More broadly, if we draw an arbitrary closed surface inside the fluid, the net rate of flow entering the surface has to be zero, as otherwise a net expansion or compression would be taking place. So the velocity field must be such that all velocities through the surface somehow have to add up to zero, and that must also be true for any arbitrary surface drawn in the fluid. The mathematical consequence of this is that the velocity field is said to be divergence-free. The divergence of a velocity field computes its spatial variations in all three directions, and when the divergence of the velocity is zero, then the velocity varies by just the right amount to ensure that no volume of fluid can ever be compressed or expanded. Fluid dynamics. In order to capture how a fluid deforms in response to forces, we need to carefully define what it means to apply a force on a moving fluid. In the absence of motion, we already discussed in Chapter 1 the two types of forces acting on fluid particles. First, we discussed the force of gravity. This type of forcing is known as a volume force. If we consider a small volume, capital V, of fluid, each particle in the volume experiences the force of gravity. Remove the fluid from the volume, and the gravitational force disappears. This does not apply just to fluids, and even for humans, gravity is a volume force. Adults have larger weights than infants due to their larger mass. In most situations of interest, Gravity is the only volume force to consider in a fluid, and it tends to play an important role for fluids on length scales of millimetres or more, while small-scale fluid mechanics is usually not affected appreciably by gravity. Another type of volume force is the electric force for fluids that carry net electric charges and are subject to an external electric field, a situation rarely encountered in our daily life, but important in many industrial uses of ionic fluids. The second type of force acting on a fluid discussed in Chapter 1 was the pressure. Recall that the pressure is the internal force pushing against a surface, per unit of surface area, and that the pressure is isotropic, meaning its value is the same in all directions. The pressure is an example of a surface force. In contrast to volume forces, surface forces act along, well, a surface. If we consider our small volume of fluid, capital V, bounded by a surface, capital S, with fluid on both sides, the surface forces are due to the fluid immediately on the other side of capital S acting on it, not due to the fluid particles inside the volume. An intuitive experience of surface force in our daily life is the wind we feel when we ride a bike or stick a hand outside the car window. It is only due to the surface of our bodies, and not what is inside, that we experience this force. Surface forces play a very important role in fluid motion, as they often dominate the dynamics. As a result, scientists have given surface forces a special name, and they are referred to as tractions. The traction at a given point for a given small surface area, capital S, with fluid on either side of capital S, is the force exerted by one fluid across the surface on the fluid located on the other side, per unit of surface area. The force due to the fluid pressure is an example of a traction, which acts directly perpendicular to the surface. Put simply, the pressure always pushes against the surface. When the fluid is not in motion, pressure is the only traction, and in that case, it is called the static pressure. One of the most fundamental questions in fluid mechanics is the intuitive understanding of what the surface tractions are when fluids are in motion. To help with intuition, let us consider a situation from our daily life. A heavy book sits on a table, and you start pushing on it so as to make it slide across the table. The table experiences two surface tractions as a result of the presence of the book. First, the weight of the book acts as a downward force on it. Since the book is at equilibrium, the reaction force from the table balances the weight, and therefore, by Newton's third law, the table experiences a downward traction perpendicular to its surface. Further, since the book is moving, it experiences a frictional force exerted by the table, and therefore, due again to Newton's third law, the book exerts a frictional surface traction in the direction parallel to the tabletop. Two components of the traction are therefore acting on the table, one perpendicular to the surface of the table and one parallel to it. The same decomposition into components applies for fluids in motion. If we consider a small surface drawn in the middle of a fluid in motion, the traction acting on the surface has two components, one perpendicular to the surface and one parallel to it, and scientists use the word stress to denote each component of the traction. The perpendicular traction is called the normal stress, while the part of the traction acting parallel to the surface is called the tangential stress. In the absence of motion, there is no tangential stress, and the only normal stress is the static pressure. How is this different when the fluid moves? Answering this question rigorously is difficult because it requires the use of complex mathematical machinery, but it can be intuitively summarized as follows. In addition to the static pressure present in the fluid at rest, the stress in a moving fluid is made up of two components. First, it is possible to separate mathematically the part of the normal stress that takes the same value for any orientation of the small surface, that is, the isotropic part of the normal stress. This is called the dynamic pressure by analogy with the isotropic static pressure. When there is no flow, the dynamic pressure is zero. In contrast, in a fluid in motion, the total pressure, that is, the total component of the perpendicular force acting per unit of surface area that has the same value in all directions, is the sum of the static pressure and the dynamic pressure. But the stress is not made up of just a pressure. The extra non-pressure stress is due to friction in the fluid and is called a viscous stress. There is a normal viscous stress, So the total normal stress is the pressure plus the normal viscous stress, and there is a tangential viscous stress. Both viscous stresses are zero in the absence of motion. Physically, viscous stresses in a moving fluid are analogous to the frictional force experienced by the table in this example, as a result of the sliding motion of the book. Because we have an intuitive understanding of the concept of static pressure, the dynamic pressure does not challenge our understanding. The pressure has one value when the fluid does not move, and it is natural to expect that it would change under fluid motion. The genuinely new concept, and one of the most important notions in fluid mechanics, is that of a viscous stress. At its most basic level, viscous stresses measure all the non-pressure forces acting internally in the fluid due to its frictional resistance to motion. We know from our daily life that not all fluids flow with the same ease. It is straightforward for water to flow out of a bottle, while it takes a lot of effort to squeeze honey out of one. And this difference is measured by an important material property of a fluid called the viscosity. Viscosity. The simplest way to understand what the viscosity of a fluid represents is to use a simple thought experiment, often attributed to Newton and illustrated in Figure 10. Consider a simple fluid located between two parallel identical surfaces of area capital A, which are separated by a distance h. The bottom surface is kept immobile, while the top surface slides with steady speed, capital U. Because of the friction in the fluid, an external force, capital F, has to be applied in order to make the surface move, and when we no longer apply the force, the motion eventually stops. The fundamental question is then, what is the value of capital F? This classical experiment and multiple variations of it have been realized over the years, all coming to the same conclusion. First, with everything else being fixed, the force capital F is found experimentally to be linearly proportional to the surface area of the plates, capital A. Double the area, and you double the force. In other words, the important quantity is not so much the force as it is the force per unit of surface area, that is, the tangential stress. Second, the force, and therefore the tangential stress, is found to vary linearly with the velocity of the top plate, capital U. If you double the speed, you double the stress required to make the surface move at that speed. Third, the force is found to be inversely proportional to the distance, h, between the plates. If you divide h by 2, the stress doubles, and it is therefore harder to put fluids in motion in thin gaps than in wide geometries. It is important to realise that these three properties of the dependence of capital F on the parameters of the experiment setup, linear variation with capital A and capital U, and inversely proportional to h, could not have been postulated without carrying out an experimental study. They are not the consequence of a mathematical calculation or a grand theory, but instead are empirical results capturing the observed behaviour of simple fluids in motion. We can use, however, a mathematical formula to quantify Newton's observations. If repeated measurements are made for the values of capital F as a function of capital A, capital U, and h, and we plot the ratio capital F divided by capital A as a function of capital U divided by h, we obtain a straight line passing through the origin, confirming that one quantity is directly proportional to the other. The ratio capital F divided by capital A is the tangential stress acting on the surface, while the ratio capital U divided by h has dimension of inverse time and is called the shear rate. The linearity between tangential stress and shear rate for simple fluids can be written mathematically as equation 2. Where the coefficient of proportionality, mu, is a constant called the dynamic viscosity, a material property of the fluid whose value depends only on temperature. The dimensions of the dynamic viscosity in capital S, capital I units are given as kilograms per meter squared, which can also be written as Pascal squared, where we recall that a Pascal, Pa, is the unit for pressure, that is, 1 Pascal is equal to 1 kilogram per meter squared. At room temperature, the dynamic viscosity of water is mu sub water is approximately equal to 10 to the power of negative 3 Pascal squared, while the value for air is smaller. Mu sub air is approximately equal to 1.8 multiplied by 10 to the power of minus 5 pascal squared. The mathematical law in equation 2 is now known as Newton's empirical law of viscosity. It agrees with our physical interpretation of the viscosity as an internal fluid friction. A more viscous fluid experiences more friction and therefore requires a larger external force to be applied in order to be moved at a given speed. Furthermore, the relationship in equation 2 can be used to clarify the classification of simple versus complex fluids, first proposed in Chapter 1. Simple fluids are those that always obey Newton's linear empirical law of viscosity, and they are therefore called Newtonian fluids. Complex fluids then refer to any material with non-Newtonian properties. Shear flow. The setup shown in Figure 10 is called a shear experiment. While it is apparently very simple, it has far-reaching consequences. By measuring the force on the moving plates, one can directly calculate the viscosity of the fluid, and therefore shear flows are used in viscosity measuring devices called rheometers. The field of rheology is devoted to characterizing the material properties of fluids, and all rheometers use versions of this shear experiment in order to measure viscosities. Beyond viscosity measurement, the shear experiment allows us to learn more about fluid motion. Using small tracer particles, one can characterize the flow field directly between the two surfaces. By doing so, we learn two important facts about moving fluids. The first one is that the velocity of the fluid close to any surface is equal to the velocity of the surface. So the fluid near the bottom stationary surface does not move, while the fluid near the moving plate moves with velocity capital U. This property is a fundamental fact of all fluid motion, and is called the no-slip boundary condition. Intuitively, it is well known that if you dip your toes in a pond or your hand in a bath, they will still be wet after you remove them. Indeed, if a surface is put in contact with a liquid and then removed, the no-slip condition implies that the nearby fluid cannot help but move along with it. So you can start blaming no-slip for getting wet. An important fact about the flow in Figure 10 is the variations of the velocity across the experimental setup. We saw that the flow speed was equal to zero at the bottom and equal to capital U at the top. As it turns out, the flow speed varies exactly linearly between these two values across the fluid. If Y denotes the coordinate perpendicular to the surfaces, equal to capital O at the bottom and H at the top, the fluid speed at position y is then obtained as u, open parenthesis, y, close parenthesis, is equal to capital U, y, divided by h. This linear flow is called a shear flow. Since the flow is linear, the rate of change of the velocity across the fluid, that is, how much u changes as y changes, is constant and equal to the shear rate, capital U divided by h. A shear flow is also known as a Coët flow, named after the French engineer and scientist Maurice Coët, who at the end of the 19th century carried out a lot of fundamental work on the no-slip condition and viscosity measurements using simple flow setups. A final property of fluid motion, highlighted by a shear flow, is that of reversibility. The result for the force in equation 2 shows that if the plate speed is changed from capital U to negative capital U, the force capital F is transformed into negative capital F. That is, the force remains of the same magnitude, but it acts in the opposite direction. This is called the reversibility property of viscous flows, and it implies that in order to apply a net force on a viscous fluid, in general, a simple back-and-forth action is not very efficient. Indeed, in the shear experiment, if you move a plate with velocity capital U for a period of time, and then reverse the motion and move with speed, negative capital U, for the same amount of time, the total force applied on the fluid is zero. Small biological appendages, called cilia, used by cells to transport fluid, for example for mucus clearance in our lungs, deform periodically, using a back-and-forth motion, and therefore have to find a way to bypass this reversibility constraint. They do so by undergoing motion that is asymmetric, with large deformation in one half of their beating stroke and a smaller one in their return stroke. The Navier-Stokes equations. In this chapter, we highlighted a number of important properties of fluid motion, from flow kinematics and deformation to stresses and viscosity. These ideas were put on a strong mathematical footing in the 19th century by two scientists whose names are forever associated with fluid mechanics: Claude Navier from France and George Stokes, who was born in Ireland and carried out his work in Cambridge. We now call the set of mathematical equations describing the dynamics of the velocity, U, and pressure fields, P, in an incompressible Newtonian fluid, the Navier-Stokes equations. Although we will not attempt to derive or solve them, it is instructive to reproduce them here, if only to admire the beauty of their mathematical structure. Using T to denote time, and rho, the mass density of the fluid, the Navier-Stokes equations are written formally as in equation 3, where the gradient symbol is a differential operator that involves spatial derivatives of the fields, and the partial symbol is for partial differentiation. Many mathematical subtleties and challenges remain associated with these equations.